Welcome to today's program. I'm Rick Mullaney, the director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and welcome to Policy Matters, the radio program that takes a close look at public policy issues that matter to you and to the future of our city, state, and nation. Today is a very special program, and thanks for being with us. Today, we are very pleased to have Roger McNamee, a venture capitalist and investor for more than three decades in Silicon Valley, an accomplished musician, activist, and author of the book Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Mr. McNamee makes a very compelling case that Facebook and big technology companies pose a serious threat to our democracy and privacy and much, much more. Roger, welcome to the program. Thank you for being with us.
Rick, it's a delight to be here today.
Roger, you were at Jacksonville University last night, and you're here in Jacksonville courtesy of the World Affairs Council. Welcome to Jacksonville. We're thrilled to have you here.
Well, I will tell you, last night's event was, it was just too much fun. I have been on my book tour now for 9 months, and I've done approximately 200 events, and last night was among the absolute best of the whole bunch.
Well, thank you for that, and I hope it'll be matched tonight, because tonight at 7 p.m., you're going to be at the University of North Florida, a great university. Tickets are still available, and I want our listening audience to know that if they contact the World Affairs Council, they can hear you at 7 p.m. at UNF, and I hope they will come, because I want to talk about last night. At the beginning, I said it was compelling, that I thought the audience would find it compelling and sobering and a call to action. They found it to be all that. And so what I'd like to do, okay with you, is to start this discussion in 2006 when you had your first meeting with Mark Zuckerberg. Can you tell our listening audience about that meeting?
So the scene of this is that at that time I was 50 years old. I'd been in the investment business half my life, a little bit more than 24 years. And I get an email in the morning saying, would you be willing to meet with Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook? This is from a senior executive at Facebook. The company was 2 years old. Mark had just turned 22. They didn't even have a news feed yet. It was only available to high school students and college students using their electronic mail address from school. But I was already convinced Facebook was going to be the next big thing, that it would eventually be bigger than Google was at that time, which is to say it was going to be one of the most successful tech companies ever. And I was convinced that because I thought that this notion that you had to use your school email address, that that authenticated identity would protect Facebook from the trolls that had overwhelmed every prior social network. And I thought that was going to make all the difference in the world. So I was very excited to meet Mark.
Now, Roger, at this time, they only had about 9 million in revenue. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, it was tiny. They had 9 million members, 9 million in revenues. It was basically all ads for pizza companies. Okay. And, you know, it was a kid's product. And I was looking at this thinking to myself, no, this is going to be much more valuable to parents and grandparents, people who really don't have much time and have lots of people they want to stay in touch with. And so I was excited to meet Mark. And the first meeting was unlike anything I've ever experienced in my life. And I describe it in detail in the book, but the short form of this is that we started the meeting with me saying to him why I took the meeting and my belief that Facebook was the next big thing, but he was never going to get a chance to prove that because either Microsoft or Yahoo was going to acquire the company for $1 billion and everybody he knew was going to tell him to take the money. What followed my explaining that to him, keep in mind, this is the first 2 minutes of our entire relationship. I've laid this very heavy concern of mine on him. It was the most astonishing meeting ever. And the short answer to this was, it turns out that the reason for the meeting was that the thing I was predicting had just happened. And every detail of what I had said to him had just happened. And so he thinks I'm clairvoyant. And he has a problem because his whole management team, his board of directors, want to sell the company, and he doesn't want to.
By the way, Roger, I do want to point this out for our listeners. It's not as though that would be an unreasonable notion in the sense that $1 billion for a company that's generating $9 million at the time, you could see why Mark Zuckerberg wanted to meet with you, why this would be troubling.
I can also understand why everybody else wanted to sell the company. He was 22 years old, and you know the company's 2 years old, and it's basically got no revenue and hardly any users. And it's, you know, it would not be obvious to a person who was not intimate with technology why this company would become a giant success. But to me, Mark was very unusual in a very good way. He was a classic Silicon Valley entrepreneur of the first rank. And I really liked working with him. I spent 3 years as an advisor helping him build a management team that was purpose-built to creating a successful venture, the company that became Facebook. And the most important thing I did was to suggest that he hire Sheryl Sandberg as the chief operating officer and then help to bring her into the company. You can imagine that having helped him keep the company independent and then bringing Sheryl in, I would be really proud of my role in this company, which I was. And in a long career where I've worked with all of the leading lights of tech, my relationship to Facebook was really unusual, and I was super proud of it. And it never occurred to me I would ever become an activist or a critic of the company. It never occurred to me that I would ever have a reason to be a critic. And when it happened, which was at the very beginning of 2016, I was put in the situation where my friends, Mark and Sheryl Sandberg, were inadvertently undermining democracy and public health at that time. That's what I could see. And I warned them 9 days before the U.S. election.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that. You have a 2006 meeting, a very significant right. one, in which he turns down $1 billion eventually. And then 10 years later, a different meeting in 2016, 10 years later. And I want to talk a little bit about what led to that meeting. By the way, for our listeners, you're listening to Policy Matters. This is WJCT 89.9. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and our special guest today is Roger McNamee. He is a more than 35 years in an investor in Silicon Valley, a musician, an author. He's written a book on called Zucked, Facing Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, and we're very pleased to have him as our guest today. You outlined that first meeting, but between 2006, and 2016, you began to see some warning signs, not only in Facebook, but in Silicon Valley. How about describing that for us?
So the key thing to understand is that from 1956 to 2004, Silicon Valley's culture was really informed by the space program. You know, that had been the exciting thing when Silicon Valley became a place that really mattered for technology. And the culture of the space program, that optimism, that determination, that focus, that commitment to empowering the people who use technology was so deep in Silicon Valley's DNA that I thought it was permanent. It never occurred to me it would ever move off of that. And I was drawn to that, you know, like a moth to a flame. And what happened was when the bubble burst, the internet bubble burst in 2000, there was a crater left behind, and the venture capital industry retreated. Entrepreneurs basically went out of business, and there was a brief period of time where nothing was going on. And into that void stepped a group of geniuses who had collectively founded PayPal, the payments company, and they had a couple of insights about the future of Silicon Valley. First, that the internet, which at that time was a web of pages, would be transitioning to becoming a web of people. That was the idea that led to social media in the first place. But the more profound insight that they had was that the constraints that had limited what you could do with technology for the prior 50 years, the limits on processing power, memory, storage, and bandwidth, would soon disappear. And that for the first time in history, you would be able to make a global consumer product that didn't have any compromises. You wouldn't have to listen to customers. You could impose your will on them. That was unimaginable before 2000.
And Roger, I assume this is the wave that would be ridden by Facebook and Google and Microsoft yes. and Amazon, all of them.
So what essentially happened was that Google was the first one to take advantage of it. But what the PayPal mafia did was they started LinkedIn, they financed Facebook, and they began a wave of new companies that were purpose-built for that environment. And the success of those early players, which was huge, I mean, both LinkedIn and Facebook were magnificently successful. So they attracted a lot of other people. And where LinkedIn and Facebook created really valuable services that billions of people use, they were followed into the market by people with more dodgy propositions. And it, you know, many of them became viable. I mean, Spotify became valuable, but it became valuable because they took advantage of musicians. And then you had Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, whose starting premise was that they could break the law and get away with it. And then you had Juul, which whose starting premise was we're going to make flavored nicotine for children. I mean, that's a terrible thing to do. And then finally you had WeWork, right, which has recently been in the news as this massive flame up. And so Silicon Valley's culture went from technology that empowered people to technology that really treated human beings as a natural resource, a source of fuel. That culturally was a huge problem for me, and it really triggered my decision to retire. That in 2012, I realized that the best and brightest in Silicon Valley were creating businesses that conflicted with my value system.
You're listening to Roger McNamee. He's our special guest today on Policy Matters, a program here on WJCT 89.9. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Very pleased to have him with us today. And what you've described, of course, in 2006, you're meeting with Mark Zuckerberg, and this change in Silicon Valley is starting to happen?
It's not visible. It doesn't really become visible until about 2010. The only person I know who spotted it before that was a professor at Harvard named Shoshana Zuboff. And for our listeners, if you have the time, I really strongly recommend you read her book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. It is a brilliant study of how Google became Google and the extraordinary lengths they go to invade what were previously the sanctuaries in our lives, to gather all the digital breadcrumbs we leave behind when we go through the economy. Every time we use a credit card, every time we use our cell phone, every location we're at, every store we buy from, you know, all of our medical history. They collect all of that stuff and they construct data voodoo dolls that use to predict our behavior. Because if you're Google or Facebook or Amazon or Microsoft, essentially the whole world is your customer. And so if you look at life events, say buying a car or getting married or buying a home or having a baby, and you look at the experience of every single person in the universe and all the steps they take before each of those life events, you can then track when new people get on that same path. And so you look for all those common things, and they use these data voodoo dolls to predict the probability that you might buy a new car or the probability that you're going to get married or that you're going to have a baby. And Google in particular has gotten extraordinarily good at this. And I believe they have something like a 90% capability to predict a woman is pregnant before she knows. And the thing is, all this is going on without our being aware of it. And my purpose here is not to criticize these people. They're good people, but they have a different value system,
Reggie,
and we need to have a conversation about it.
Well, you eventually in 2016 would go meet and talk to Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg.
I sent them an email, but because at that by that point in time, they were so important that getting on their calendar might have taken.
And then met with some of their top leadership. But what I'd like to ask you is, there were several warning signs that you didn't do that. You didn't do that lightly. There were several warning signs. Could you outline for us what those warning signs that led you to write to Mark Zuckerberg?
So there were signals along the way. And by the time I saw them, which was January 2016, the ones I saw were in two areas, politics, really democracy, and civil rights. The first one occurred during the Democratic primary in New Hampshire in January 2016. I started to see Facebook posts being shared first by one of my friends and then progressively more of them in the days thereafter that were essentially pieces of hate speech. And ostensibly, they were originating from a Facebook page associated with the Bernie Sanders campaign. And I didn't believe they were authentic. And yet my friends were sharing them. And the number of friends doing the sharing was growing so rapidly that my conclusion, as somebody who really understood Facebook, was that whoever was running that Facebook group was using advertising to attract my friends into the group. And that struck me as something really wrong. The second thing that happened a couple months later, so March of 2016, related to the civil rights group Black Lives Matter, where a corporation was using the advertising tools at Facebook to gather personal information about people who were literally just learning about it, right? They were just asking questions or participating in dialogues about it. And they were selling that data to police departments, which is a violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Bill of Rights. That really scared me. But the pièce de résistance, the one that really catalyzed me, was in June. The United Kingdom voted on whether to leave the European Union or remain, what is now known as Brexit. And that was when I realized, oh my gosh, bad actors can use Facebook's advertising tools to interfere in democracy. And that was the point at which I start looking for allies. I start really digging in deeply. And I persuade a friend of mine to let me write an op-ed for the biggest tech blog, Recode. And I was working on that in September and early October when the news came out from our intelligence agencies that the Russians were actively interfering in the 2016 election. And news came out from the Department of Housing and Urban Development of another civil rights violation taking place on Facebook. And that's when I realized I got to reach out to Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg. And so I contacted my friends and I sent them basically a finished draft of this opinion piece, which I did not publish. I sent it to them to warn them, to say, guys, there is something about the business model, the algorithms, and the culture of Facebook that is allowing bad people to hurt innocent people. And I was trying to warn my friends to protect this company I loved. It never occurred to me that these problems would be the result of conscious business decisions, that there was nobody at Facebook who wanted the Russians to interfere in democracy or wanted bad people to harm the civil rights of other people.
It was the model.
But that the business model itself made those outcomes inevitable and that they didn't care enough to alter the business model.
Now, this memo that you sent to Mark Zuckerberg and to Sheryl, you've included it in your book.
It's in the book. So you can see, you know, warts and all, the thing that I sent to them. And, you know, in retrospect, I wish I had rewritten it from the form of an op-ed into a memo to my friends. But I spent 3 months privately speaking first to Mark and Sheryl and then to other senior people at Facebook, trying to persuade them that no matter what the law said, Facebook depended on the trust of the people who use it. And that if the people who use Facebook decided that Facebook was responsible for violating civil rights or undermining democracy, and keep in mind, when I first reached out to them, all we had to go on was the Democratic primary and Brexit. Obviously, since then, we've had a lot more things, not just in the U.S., but in Brazil and India and all around the world.
And you reached out before the testimony to Congress, of course. I mean,
I reached out to them before the 2016 election, yeah. So more than a year before the about a year before the first hearing and a year and a half before Mark went to Washington. And, you know, what I knew at that time was a small sliver of what I know now. And the thing that I try to explain to people when we're looking at this is to recognize that the things we love about the internet are good things. Social media is a great thing. Search is a great thing. But the business model being used by Google, by Facebook, by Microsoft, by Amazon, encourages them to do things that no corporation should do. You know, the notion of Alexa, which is an Amazon product, being in people's bedrooms or in their offices, listening all the time, those should be sanctuaries. Companies should be not invading that. And these corporations basically say, if we touch a piece of data, no matter how intimate it is, if we touch it, we own it, we can do what we like, which is analogous to going to the doctor, having the doctor repair your broken arm, and then claiming that they own your arm. I mean, it's nuts. I believe that personal data, because you can recreate a human being, you can make a data voodoo doll and therefore anticipate their behavior and then manipulate it. Because of that, I think we should be treating personal data as a civil right, as a human right, not an asset. We should not be buying and selling data. And the reason we shouldn't is, it's not like I want to deny you getting paid for your data. It's that the way it's being used now affects all of society. If you were in El Paso, Texas at that Walmart, you didn't have to be on Facebook. You didn't have to be on Google to be dead. You just need to be in the wrong place at the right time. Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, those mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, the Rohingya people in Myanmar, the victims of death squads in the Philippines. These are life and death things that were enabled primarily by Facebook, but also by some of the other internet platforms. And they are the result of a business model and a culture and algorithms that do not recognize a sense of responsibility for the consequences of their success. And I just think that it's time to have a serious conversation about that. It may be that everybody decides that this is okay behavior, but I'm sitting there going, the more you know, the creepier it gets.
Well, I'm glad we're having the conversation. For our listeners, you're listening to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9 FM. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and our special guest today is Roger McNamee, who's written a book, Zucked, and he's outlined in his book, and as he is here in Jacksonville, a very compelling narrative about the threat posed not only by Facebook, quite frankly, but by big technology companies in particular.
Not all of them. So it's Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon.
And we could talk about some good actors. We could talk about Apple in a second. But one of the things I want to talk about in your book, you mention, and you've already touched on this some, Roger, but you've mentioned four things in particular that are pretty sobering in terms of the threat posed. One is to democracy.
Yeah.
One is to privacy. One is to public health. And one is to innovation, capitalism, competition. We still have some time, but I do want to touch on those threats and then spend a little bit of time on solutions.
So let me combine all those things into one thing. The best thing about what I'm doing now is that in a country that is polarized on almost every political issue imaginable, I have stumbled on the one issue that can bring us all together. It doesn't matter who I'm talking to. Everyone cares about these issues. There are a million people who work at those four companies, at Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Amazon. There's 7.2 billion people in the world. So I like our chances.
So this is not a red or blue issue.
No, we got our numbers. No, this isn't right or left. This is right or wrong, okay? And I'm saying that no corporation should have the right to manipulate the behavior of the people who use its products. I just think that's inherently a bad thing. And for sure, no corporation has the right to undermine the mental health of children. No corporation has the right to undermine democracy. They should not have the right to take away your freedom to make choices without fear, which is my definition of privacy. And God knows the economy depends on innovation. And so we don't like monopoly, right? Monopoly is just terrible for innovation. And so the thing that excites me is that in 2020, we've got an election coming up, and it doesn't matter what party you're on, doesn't matter where you normally stand on any other issue. On this issue, we can actually all come together because there are issues of national security embedded into this. There are issues of really liberty in the old-fashioned Revolutionary War Declaration of Independence sense. This notion of, as an individual, you should be in control of your own choices. And if you do not realize it, you can be manipulated really easily because with these data voodoo dolls, Facebook and Google in particular can make predictions about your behavior. But because they control your search results in your news feed, they can use the data voodoo doll to control the choices that are available to you. And I think if people understood that, if they understood that Google Maps doesn't always give you the shortest time. It gives the one that balances the load across the entire network. If they understood that Pokemon Go was a massive experiment in behavioral manipulation, it felt like a game, but what was really going on was they were testing their ability to manipulate your behavior. If they understood that smart cities are being designed in a way that will inevitably replace consumer choice and democracy with algorithmic processes, then I think we could have a really thoughtful conversation about what to do about it. And in my mind, that's the beauty, because while there are four problems, there are only two areas we need to think about when we're looking for solutions. We need to think about competition, because the economy depends on innovation, particularly our economy. And these guys are monopolists, and they're basically blocking the sunlight that's necessary to allow.
Now, when you're talking about competition, you've outlined what users being aware of this can maybe do, but now we're getting into over to the policy side, policy reaction, maybe antitrust laws and some other approaches.
Well, let me talk to this. So the competition thing, the antitrust laws are a really good guide. And the best news, and this is the thing everybody should understand, is there's nothing inevitable about what's going on right now. We've seen exactly the same thing twice before. At the beginning of the 20th century with the Standard Oil monopoly, the J.P. Morgan banking monopoly, and the Vanderbilt transportation monopoly. And we fixed that by simply saying companies have a choice. They can either make a marketplace or they can participate. They can't do both. And under no circumstances are they allowed to do things that prevent others from having an opportunity to compete. And then beginning in 1956, we changed the regulation of the AT&T telephone monopoly. And the intersection of those two things provides a great blueprint for increasing competition. I'm very excited about that. And the great news is I'm working with the Trump administration, with the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, with the Federal Trade Commission, but also with many states' attorneys general. And there's a lot of interest across all party lines. We have 50 states and territories that are in an antitrust case against Google and 47 against Facebook. So by definition, we've got people of every persuasion. Then you got to deal with the other three issues: public health, privacy, and democracy. And it turns out those problems all exist because of the surveillance capitalism business model these guys use, that all of this data is being used in ways that harm us. That essentially, you've heard there's a story about Facebook out now where they're allowing people to lie in political ads, to have false things in political ads, and they're not going to police it. And people are rightly offended by this. I mean, that's just inherently bad for democracy. Well, why does this exist? It exists because it turns out if you want people to spend a lot of time on your site, the most effective way to do it is to either scare them or make them outraged. Well, what kind of content does that? Hate speech, disinformation, conspiracy theories. Those are the fuel for the business models of YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and others. And they're never going to fix the problems with their platforms until we force them to do so.
Does that force include
the regulatory? That's what we've
got to do. Is that part of the regulatory scheme?
First, it has to be going with politics. We have to show that the users are not going to tolerate this behavior. That gives the backbone to the politicians to do what's necessary. And the right thing to do is to say, data is a human right. We're not going to have any third-party market and private data, and you're not allowed to use it. No micro-targeting, no algorithmic amplification of content. That you just can't do that anymore. That was a mistake. It's like the chemicals companies in the 50s, which would pour mercury into fresh water or leave the mine residue on the side of a hill and cause massive damage. And they were super profitable because they didn't pay for that. But we eventually woke up and said, we're going to make you pay. It's time to make Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Amazon pay the cost of the toxic digital spills that they're
creating. Are you optimistic that this can be done, Roger?
Oh, definitely. I mean, 3 years ago, there was nobody to talk to. And now you can't go anywhere without people talking about it. I'm so excited because I think the 2020 election, this is going to be a giant issue all over the place, because it doesn't matter what your party persuasion is, you can run on this issue. And it's a thing where, unless your constituents, you know, your territory is the headquarters of one of these companies, you're going to
very briefly, what's next for Roger McNamee?
Well, I'm going from here to Dublin, Ireland to participate in an international gathering of parliamentarians who are focused on this issue. And I'm going to be testifying in front of these people in Dublin on Thursday.
Roger, thank you so much for being
with
us.
What a pleasure. In Jacksonville, love y'all. This is a great time to be here, and I just had a wonderful time. So thank you all for making me feel so welcome.
Thanks to our listeners. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. You've been listening to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9. Hope you join us again next time.